It's such a delight to be here together with all of you here at CIMC. So welcome, welcome. A long time ago in my life, I was learning to play the piano and I loved it. And I remember at one point I had access to some practice rooms for playing music. And I don't know if any of you here have ever been in such a building with such musical practice rooms. The one I was in, it was this, you can say there's this hallway, and then on each side of the hall there were these small rooms, and most had a piano in there that you could play. And they were soundproof, where you could say they were sort of kind of soundproof enough so you could feel like you were in relative privacy. And one of the things I loved about these practice rooms and really about this hallway is that it was soundproof, but it was semi-soundproof, which means when I went there, I could hear others playing there. And I remember someone who practiced there at a similar time that I would go there. I kind of knew her, and I knew she had this an aspiration to be a concert pianist, and had already gone through extensive training and performing and practicing for such a long, long time. And when I'd be walking down the hall and I would hear her play, she was such an amazing pianist. Even it was almost like even from the muted sound, I could hear her, at least it felt like this, I could hear her passion and devotion she brought to her practice. But it did feel like that I could feel her commitment to practicing itself, that commitment to the hours and hours of diligent yet also easeful practice. I was moved by her. I was inspired by this commitment she had. It's true, I was never really good at playing piano, but I was inspired. And it really what I want to share with you tonight is, for me, Dharma practice can have this flavor to it. Kind of the easeful and diligent practice of an artist bringing beauty into the world. And for me, the Buddha brought beauty into the world. He brought in a possibility of a different way of being. And it was through easeful, diligent practice that a practitioner can bring such beautiful, a beautiful song of a different way of being in this world. As you can hear, hopefully you're hearing, right? I'm offering this framework, Dharma practice, as a kind of artistic endeavor. And it is, it's inspiring to me. It gives a kind of juice and energy to my Dharma practice. And I want to be clear, like when I'm sharing this with you, really any framework to understand this path is going to have advantages and disadvantages. And also, I want to be clear, I'm not saying that this is the framework you need to use for your spiritual practice, but rather it's simply an invitation to take up this notion, to play with it. And to be clear, for me, it's not the only framework I use. I just find it inspiring at times and gives fuel for my practice. And then you ask the question to yourself, oh, is this something useful to you or not? Is it inspiring? Does it raise a sense of curiosity or interest? And this, some of this talk that you're going to be hearing arose out of a book that comes from a different realm. And it's a book called The Practice of Practice by Jonathan Harnum. And it is in a different realm. It's for musicians. And quite interestingly, a practitioner had recommended it to me. They were a musician and they're like, you should read this. It has so many correlations with our Dharma practice. So a big thank you to that person, some wonderful crossover here that hopefully you'll hear. So this framework, Dharma practice, artistic endeavor, and artistic endeavor. And sometimes when I'm, you know, reading these suttas or getting a sense of how the Buddha spoke about this path, like in certain places in these early texts, it does seem like it does fit well. For example, some of you might know this, the Buddha speaks a lot about, the Pali word is bhavana, which means cultivation, as in like metta bhavana. It's the cultivation of loving kindness, that phrase would be. And so much talk about cultivating this heart and mind and cultivating it in a way that leads to awakening, that leads to release. Or there is another word that the Buddha uses, kusala, which is, it's often translated as wholesome, like engaging in a wholesome deed. Yet it can also be translated as skillfulness, like I'm learning an artistic skill that frees the heart. Like I'm learning the skill of kindness. I'm learning the skill of samadhi, collecting and unifying the mind. The skill of wise speech, the skill of mindfulness. This path and this practice, it refines artistic skills that I find bring beauty into the world. There's a stock phrase that you find used often in the early texts, you know, that says the Buddha teaches the Dhamma that's in beautiful in the beginning, beautiful in the middle, and beautiful in the end. For example, at the beginning of the Kalama Sutta, when it's giving kind of just, I think in that first paragraph there, this is a description of the Buddha. So bringing beauty into the world, like ethical integrity, sila is the Pali word. It's beautiful. The beauty of non-harming. I find there's a beauty to kindness and compassion. You know, and these are described this way. For example, like sila, sometimes it's described kalyano sila or kalyana sila, a beautiful ethical conduct. The beauty of presence, the beauty of joy, the beauty of samadhi. And I feel like we need such beauty in our world, especially in these times. The other aspect of this framework of Dharma practices as artistic endeavor is I feel like it expands dichotomy that I find sometimes taught in insight meditation. Actually, I teach about it a lot, and I find it really helpful. And it's this framework around being versus doing, and this need to stop doing and to learn to simply be. And for me, I do find this extremely helpful at times as being a practitioner. It can help prime for a sense of openness and receptivity and letting go. Yet I also find, though, if my mind holds it as some oversimplistic binary of, there only needs to be being and not a molecule of doing or shaping, I find it doesn't work for me, that it's more nuanced than this. It can undermine a sense of cultivating a skill that takes time and repetition and hours and hours and hours of practice, of the practice of our lives. And in light of this, I think of a great musician, you know, like one of the greatest jazz singers of all time, Ella Fitzgerald. She had this incredible voice, and her skill and the beauty I found was amazing. And when I listen to her, she does. She makes it sound effortless. You know, like this song, Airmail Special, just her skill. And that ease and effortlessness and beauty that she was able to express, it arose from developing and cultivating the skill of singing. Just wasn't a passive beingness that all of a sudden she was able to emanate this effortlessness and beauty. She had learned an art, the art of singing. And sometimes that's what it feels like for me is I'm learning this art, the art of the Dharma for my life. And again, yes, the framework of being rather than doing, I find helpful. It's not so much one or the other, but for me, an expansion. So, how can this sense of Dharma practice as an artistic endeavor, how can it bring the path alive? One way I've discovered this is that it allows me to get out of this perspective that sometimes can happen, this perspective of I need to sit this amount of time every day. Which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but what I've noticed is that it can start to feel like it feels like when I'm brushing my teeth, it's just something to do for emotional and mental hygiene and well-being, which is great. It's a fine thing. But there's something that gets broadened when I have this artistic vision. For practice, it touches my heart more deeply than something like just brushing my teeth. And don't get me wrong, I brush my teeth. I think it's a good thing. It's just for me, the framework of meditation as learning the artistry of something, of playing the music of the Dharma, that's what makes my heart sing. And then what arises from that is it ignites a sense of curiosity and exploration. And then I'm so curious and interested in exploring loving kindness or equanimity or appreciative joy or compassion or samadhi or being mindful of emotions and thoughts. And then I really want to sit down and meditate and learn the skill of samadhi or kindness or whatever it is, or mindfulness. So rather than, oh, I have to meditate, I have to fix it and fit it into my life. Oh, I have to brush my teeth. No, there's a passion there. There's a word for this important quality, this Dhamma Chanda. You know, Pali, in Pali, the early scriptural language, one of the early scriptural languages of Buddhism. Dhamma, the Dharma, and then Chanda is a kind of, the word I like is a kind of passion. It's a kind of skillful reaching. And I'm tying this in just with that first story I shared with you. I was so inspired by the passion and devotion of the pianist I heard playing, you know, when I was in the in those music rooms. So moving. And this is the Buddha I discover. At least I do in this tradition. Like I invite you to imagine. Like, if you to imagine the Buddha leaving the palace that he was in to set out on a spiritual journey. And if I take that in, here he has such a comfortable life, and there he's going to be living a life of asceticism. And when I get a sense of that, I think to myself, now that's a person who has deep passion for freedom. Just like great musicians have a passion about music. And it's useful for me to have this kind of passion, excitement about an artistic endeavor when I sit down and meditate. The world expands of the Dharma. And then it's not about getting it right or getting it wrong. Rather, it's just about learning. It's about discovering. And the world-renowned great flute player Sir James Galway put it well. He says, I don't consider myself as having mastered the flute, but I get a real kick out of trying. I think the joy of continuing to learn and learn and learn, the joy of artistic endeavor. Right? And to me, what James Galway is pointing to is this skill of being passionate about an artistic endeavor without it getting entangled in the craving and grasping of needing to be somebody special or great. It's really residing in learning and discovering. This is a possible fruitfulness of this perspective, this framework of Dharma practice as artistic endeavor. So the book, I need to get the book, The Practice of Practice. But one of the foundations, there's just one interesting thing in this book that I want to share with you. So one of the foundations of learning how to engage in regular practice skillfully is cultivating, this comes from the book, a growth mindset instead of a fixed mindset. The idea of a growth mindset and fixed mindset, it comes from research from Carol Dweck. And she did this research on these mindsets and how they affect learning and motivation. And this growth mindset and fixed mindset, she was looking at it in the context of intelligence. And what I appreciate about the book, it is it expands this into the context of learning a skill like the skill of playing music. And then I'm expanding it into the skills that we're learning and refining on in Dharma practice. So the fixed mindset. The fixed mindset, it's this a view that this is the way I am and I can't change. And yes, caveat to this. I find it important to accept myself, to really have this deep quality of acceptance of how I am right now. And it's important to notice that growth is possible. Growth is possible even in the last days as I'm dying. And that's what the growth mindset is. It's just that growth is possible. So again, fixed mindset, this is the view that this is the way I am, and I can't change. Growth mindset, really simple. Oh, there's potential here in this mind and heart to grow. The way I understand the teachings of karma, of kamma, is that they're really powering in this way because they are all about the growth mindset. And I find that so often around kamma or karma, it's misunderstood. These teachings are often taken as an affirmation of a fixed mindset. Like, for example, it's this idea of I did something skillful in the past, and now it's just playing out, and there's nothing I can do about it. But that's not actually what the Buddha was precisely pointing to in the teaching of karma. It's more, okay, I might have done something unskillful in the past. That's happened. And right now, there is this possibility in this moment to shape this mind stream. Oh, it's in the here and now that I can allow the stream of my heart and mind to go in a different direction. So, right, yeah, there is a past conditioning I'm contending with. And then the empowering quality of the teaching of kamma is noticing through practice there's a chance to shape that in a different direction. And then there is that comes from that, oh, this possibility to shape how my life unfolds. I did something unskillful. Oh, and now I can apologize for that act and make amends. It doesn't fix, but it allows my heart and mind to move in a little bit different direction. So karma, it shows that there is a potential for us to grow and transform in order to have more freedom in our lives. It arises out of this growth mindset. And this is important because I think the opposite really is this trap. It says in the book, I want to share with you a quote from the book here. It says, when people with a fixed mindset experience failure or even a few difficulties, they often abandon the task because it feels like evidence to them that they're not smart or not good at the task. This is yet another blow to the ego because any kind of failure is taken as a reflection of one's own fundamental nature. Of course, nobody likes to look stupid. But to a person with a fixed mindset, like looking stupid, or you could say doing something unskillful, it ends up being the same thing as being stupid. It's a small but absolutely vital distinction. And then the book goes on. On the other hand, those with a growth mindset believe that intelligence or skill in this context is something that can be grown. Effort, work, and challenges are what make intelligence or a certain skill grow and flower and bear juicy fruit. People with a growth mindset aren't as attached to demonstrating their intelligence or skill because they know intelligence can be increased. And so intelligence isn't a fundamental, unvarying aspect of their sense of self. Then he says, notice I said aren't as attached, which I appreciate. And then he goes, we're all sensitive to what others think about us. Nobody likes to look dumb, but if you hold a growth mindset set, when you fail or are faced with a difficult challenge, it's not such a blow to the ego. People with a growth mindset understand that failure is a form of assessment telling you that you need to approach the problem from a different angle. Failure is an opportunity to learn for someone with a growth mindset, not an example of your fundamental lack of skill. So hopefully you're hearing that a growth mindset, it requires me to have kindness and compassion towards myself because I'm going to make mistakes. This is what comes with learning. So it requires I love myself. So the mindset you bring to this path and practice makes a huge difference. And I invite you to become curious. Is the mindset that's there for you, is it more predominantly the fixed mindset or the growth mindset? What are the ways to nurture the growth mindset if this resonates for you? And at the same time, I want to be clear. I mean, this is such a fundamental insight of this path and this practice is I don't have complete control about what mindset is at play. This is such an important insight. You could say it's a facet of this insight into not self. Because there's all this conditioning of this mind that's happened. That angles my perception in a certain direction. So again, I'm just coming back to this point of it's so important for me at least to have a quality of kindness and compassion when navigating this terrain and nurturing a growth mindset. And then there's another element in terms of this framework of Dharma practice as artistic endeavor that I want to share with you, and this has to do with what I'd call environment or context, the context that I find myself in. Because it has such a huge impact in terms of being a human being. And the example I'd like to share with this is about my partner Robin. And for my partner, music was a huge part of the family culture, of her family culture. So when she was growing up, she was just swimming in this world of playing music. And for her, she jokes about this, and even some of her siblings do, learning how to harmonize while singing with others, she says it just feels like she was born with it. And the family story is that she sang harmony before she sang melody. And actually, what I want to point out about this story is that wasn't the case. She knows it wasn't the case. It was so much because of the context that she was in. She was in this field. She was swimming in this field of playing and learning music. She was continuously in that. And as a result of that, she just began to pick up how to sing and then how to harmonize. So it didn't feel like to her, oh, I have to go and practice music now. It was just so intertwined with her life. And hopefully you're hearing the overlap here with Dharma practice, which is context. Like if I can find context where I am swimming in the Dharma, oh, then my system's going to be taking this in. This to me is so much the importance of Sangha, of also spiritual friendship. It's also the purpose of being on retreat with others, to create a culture, an environment, a context, which we're surrounded by these values that we find from this path, whether that's presence or kindness, ethical conduct, patience. Being in such relationships, it deeply shapes the direction we go in. So you could say, in these contexts, environments, the process of learning an artistic skill is still happening, but the learning process can feel quite different than like going to the music room to learn piano. But that process is happening. And it's a significant part of what it is, I think, as a practitioner. To learn the Dharma is to be in such spaces. So for me, it gives me a sense of this. Like when I'm coming into a space of a Sangha or a space of retreat, I'm just allowing my heart to soak in the silence and the presence. And often what I'm also soaking in is there's like a different rhythm I'm sensing into. And what a beautiful thing to offer to each other. When you come to such spaces, you're offering your silence, your interest. It's a beautiful gift. So what I think about Sangha is that this is the most important thing, much more, I would even say, than the words I'm sharing with you, the context and community. And it also points to something is that often when I'm in a Sangha context and being a participant, it's much more about how I am than what I'm saying to create this culture. Or Georgia O'Keeffe said, I found I could say things with color and shapes that I couldn't say any other way. Things I had no words for. And for me, what that's connected with is like expressing oneself through silence. The silence of certain groups have been so transformative for me. I remember this was quite a while ago, early on in my practice, maybe this was in 1990. And I was at Amaravati in the UK there. And I think Ajahn Sumedho was the abbot then. And I was really new to practice. I'd done some practice, but especially the Theravada scene was still quite very new to me. And I remember going there, and it was sometime in the morning. And Ajahn Sumedho was just up in front of the hall, and sometimes he'd be saying something for a little while, and most of the time he was just silent. And one of the things that was so powerful for me, probably the thing that I remember most about being an Amaravati at that time, was not so much the teachings, it was just hanging around Ajahn Sumedho in his silence. I found deeply moving, and I do feel like I learned something about the Dharma through that. He was conveying things that maybe there were no words for. So surrounding oneself with sangha, with spiritual friends, it makes a difference. You know, like the said in one of this in the numerical discourses, where the Buddha says, he's speaking to the monastics, you know, and he says to them, you know, if other wanderers who are kind of members of other groups should ask you, what friend are the prerequisites, the foundation for the development of this path to awakening? You should answer, there is a case where a monastic has admirable friends, admirable companions, admirable comrades. This is the first prerequisite for the development of this path to awakening. Right? This primary foundation for this path. Good friends. I couldn't have followed this path without the support of teachers and friends along the way. I also want to acknowledge when I'm going through this, the obvious thing here in terms of this connection to learning how to play music. And I think this is really striking to tell you the truth, just because I'm using this book. Right? In music, most often you get to practice and then you have the performance. But on this path, often the practice is the performance. Right? This is, to me, the challenge of this particular artistic endeavor. I don't get to kind of practice and then do the performance. I'm on stage in some way. So in light of this, I'd like to this whole genre I'm sharing with you, this Dharma practice as artific endeavor, I'd like to share some words just in closing here from the poet Rilke in one of his letters. It's from Letters to a Young Poet. And he was writing to this young poet, Franz Kappes, who had reached out to Rilke for advice in learning the craft, the art of poetry. And also, I feel thankful for Franz Kappes because he was the one who published all of these letters after Rilke died. So, this is what Rilke says to Franz. He says, to be an artist means not to compute or to count. It means to ripen as the tree, which does not force its sap, but stands unshaken in the storms of spring with no fear that summer might not follow. It will come regardless, but it only comes to those who live as though eternity stretches before them, carefree, silent, and endless. I learn it daily. Learn it with many pains for which I am grateful. Patience. Patience is all. So artistic endeavor to inspire our hearts. And yeah, patience is so important to learn an artistic skill. So may we bring beauty into the world through learning this art of embodying the Dharma. Thank you. Thank you for your attention. Okay, well, thanks everyone. Thanks so much for this time together. I really appreciate it. And Nico, thanks so much for helping out to facilitate too. I really appreciate it. Okay, may you all take care, and again, such my heart's full with being able to connect with you all. Yeah, see ya. Okay, take care.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.